with a group like this, you can stay right where you are.
Where you prefer.
Whatever you want to stand up.
If you want to go.
Yeah, it might be a little bit. Those days have come and gone. I had some fast cars when I was younger, but I knew I was going to get myself in trouble eventually, so I have a Camry now. It's the four-cylinder Camry. There's only so much trouble you can get yourself into in a Toyota Camry. But yeah, I grew up in West Virginia, the Mountain State, and actually right out of high school, I didn't go to college right away. I went into the Marine Corps. And I was a reservist, and I worked construction for 4 years. And so I was a little bit of a, I guess you'd call it, non-traditional student by the time I actually got started. And my dual bachelor's degrees were communication studies and and psychology. So I finished those up in 98. I moved to Savannah, Georgia. That's how I ended up in Georgia. With my now ex-wife, the mother of my three daughters. Mary and I both are divorced and just remarried about a year and a half ago. We have four children together, my three girls, and she has a son who's 14. So I moved to Savannah, and I knew I wanted to go to grad school in psychology, really wanted to do clinical psychology. That was my original goal. The reason for that is my dad is a Vietnam vet and has like extreme PTSD, just treatment-resistant depression. I've seen him completely in the throes of that numerous times. Therapy escalating through electroconvulsive therapy. He's been actually, I don't know if you guys are familiar with ECT, where they shock your brain. It's like a series of six treatments. He's been through the series of six treatments, six times now. So they've shocked his brain a total of 36 times over the course of the last about 15 or 20 years at different points, and it still really doesn't solve the problem. Anyway, that piqued my interest in psychology, and I really wanted to do clinical work. I'm sort of first generation for college in my family, so I didn't know about how grad school worked. I thought if I had a really good GPA and really good GRE scores that I could get into a good clinical psychology program. I learned that wasn't the case, that there's this thing called research experience that's pretty important. And so I had good GREs, I had a 4.0 GPA at West Virginia, but I kept getting rejected from programs. And so I applied to University of Georgia's it was called biopsychology at the time. Their biopsychology program as a backup. And there was actually a primatologist who wanted me to come in because you know how the students will contribute like writing samples in their application packets? My best writing sample was a paper that I did on primate cognitive mapping. And I wasn't interested in that, but I included it in my packet and she found it fascinating. I think maybe I referenced her work or something like that. And so her goal was to bring me in and work with her as one of her graduate students. I got there, and a week after being at UGA, I switched completely to work on neuroscience projects, and that's what I stuck with for the rest of my 5.5 year master's, PhD time at UGA. And so the specific research area was pain systems. It was behavioral pharmacology, psychopharmacology, working with the endogenous cannabinoid system and trying to design drugs that would suppress pain, kind of like drugs that were better alternatives than narcotics, right? That aren't as prone to tolerance, aren't as prone to addiction, aren't as prone to overdose issues and things like that. So, all right, that's long. That's a long prelude. I better get into the meat of it. We'll be here all afternoon, right? The selling point, I think what Carl put on the email I saw was my journey from atheism to Christianity, or my journey from atheism. And yeah, so I talk about this a lot, and I got to kind of select, which points I want to emphasize. What most people typically want to hear is like why I left atheism, because I was a very committed atheist. And so what I'll talk about very briefly is, number one, how I got involved with the new atheist movement, kind of militant, for lack of a better term, evangelical atheism, right? Because I was maybe not as much as I am an evangelical Christian now, but close in terms of my passion for atheism. And then number two, how my mind was changed, and then the last part of that, how God changed my heart. Because those didn't all happen at the same time, obviously. There was quite a gap, about a 3-year gap, in fact, in between when I mentally assented to Christianity and when I really started following Christ. So I would say I grew up going to church. I believed the Bible as a kid. By the time I started college at West Virginia University, I would still have called myself a Christian. I really hadn't looked into the major issues of God versus science and all of that. It was kind of new to me. I still was pretty regular in church, but somewhere during my undergraduate trek, I think it really started with Darwinism, a class I had in biological psychology. Loved the professor, Dr. Parker. He was probably my favorite professor. Had a good rapport with him. Really enjoyed his demeanor, and he was a very approachable guy, you know. But I think for a lot of reasons, I really embraced that. I'm like, okay, this is the true explanation of how we got here. You know, Christianity has some good things about it. Some of it's probably true. Some of it's probably false. I really don't know what is what. But really, if I want to know the truth about reality, I'm going to go ask a scientist. I'm not going to ask a person with a Bible in their hand. That was sort of my attitude where I was when I left my undergraduate years. You know, still was fairly involved as a cultural Christian in church services when I started grad school at UGA. I remember even going to some Bible studies early on and enjoyed the people I was meeting. I thought this is kind of like a break from the scientific rigor. And, you know, spirituality is important. You know, everybody wants to give a little nod to that. And I still gave my nod to spirituality for the first year or so. But somewhere in those middle years of graduate school, I would say I was more cultured into atheism than I made a conscious decision to become an atheist. And what do I mean by that? I just mean everybody I worked around was a scientific naturalist. Now, very few would say I'm an atheist, but they would say, well, I don't believe in any religion, I'm not religious. What do you believe in? I believe in science. You know, that was their worldview. Basically philosophical materialism, right? Or what we might call scientific naturalism. I hate the word scientific naturalism. It's naturalism, right? They don't get to co-opt the word science into that and make it their monopoly. But what a lot of people would say is scientific naturalism. And you know, that's the view of Carl Sagan, right? Of the old Cosmos series. The cosmos is, how did he say it? All that was, all that is, all that ever will be. You know, that's the box. That box contains the entirety of reality. There's nothing outside of that box. So that quickly became my philosophical position. Not coincidentally, I quit having any affiliation with religion, but I still wouldn't have called myself an atheist. I remember distinctly what pushed me over the edge there. I guess I was functionally an atheist, but I wasn't calling myself that. A lab partner of mine named Nathan, he was an ex-Catholic, and we, over many hours of rat surgeries, experimental surgeries on rats and testing, we would talk about our backgrounds growing up, and he told me the horror stories of the nuns, you know, whipping their hands in class and all of that, and how he had become an agnostic. And, you know, I basically said I had a similar journey minus the nuns, because I grew up in a Protestant tradition, but mostly a bad experience. Mostly for me, it was fear. You know, I remember that as a kid. I'd lay in bed at night and I would think, wow, if Jesus comes back tonight, I know I'm going to hell because I'm not obeying my mom. You know, I'm cussing. I'm doing all these bad things. I tell lies. And I just had this terrible fear of hell. And so we would share stories like that. And he asked me, he said, Rich, have you read Richard Dawkins' new book? It was right after The God Delusion came out. So I'm guessing this is like 2005, 2006, somewhere in there. And I said, no, but I know who he is. He's an atheist, right? And he wrote The Selfish Gene. I'd read that. And he's like, yeah, it's the same guy. He's like, he has a new book called The God Delusion. And some of these things that you and I have been talking about how religious people think, he writes about them in this book. You really ought to check it out. And so I remember going to the Barnes & Noble in Athens that weekend and finding The God Delusion on the new releases shelf, the shiny silver cover with the orange globe in the middle of it. And, you know, I look back and I try to say, what was my attitude at the time? Because that was really important, the attitude of my heart. And what I remember when I went to buy The God Delusion was, you know, I'm going to read this. I don't really know what he's going to say yet, but whatever Richard Dawkins says, that's going to kind of be, it's going to guide my new belief system, right? I'm going to make a break here from, a solid break from my religious past and become fervently irreligious. And so that's exactly what I did. I read The God Delusion. I read really slow. I underline, write in the margins, go back and reread things. And so I finished Dawkins. Not long after that, I picked up Christopher Hitchens. I forget the sequence. Not long after that, I picked up Sam Harris, The End of Faith. You guys have heard of some of these guys before. I became an avid fan of an atheist YouTube broadcast. YouTube was kind of a new thing at the time, just a few years in. But they had episodes of what was called The Atheist Experience. It was broadcast out of Austin, Texas. And kind of their main talking head, a guy named Matt Dillahunty, who was supposedly studying to be a Southern Baptist preacher, but lost his faith and became a spokesman for atheism. I became a big fan of that show, and I would stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning watching back episodes of The Atheist Experience. And so I remember thinking, I need to be like these guys. We need something like this in Athens, Georgia. We need a call-in show. We need to have a real, like, militant presence, pushing atheism, pushing secular humanism, pushing separation of church and state. And so I started looking. I looked on Craigslist, and there was actually a meeting of skeptics coming up in Athens to try to get something started. I attended it. Nothing ever came from it. It was like herding cats. It really was. Everybody had all these ideas. Nobody wanted to implement any of the ideas. And so I kept thinking, well, what can I do from here? And so I went back to campus, and I'm like, I know, I'll start something on campus. And my first solution was to find the campus preacher guy who would come to campus about every week with his wife, John Duncan. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go down there and debate, you know, the gospel preacher there on campus. So I did that for a while. John and I actually built something of a friendship, even though ideologically we were opposed. And so I'm like, okay, well, I want to talk to other people. I'm not going to change John's mind. I want to talk to the students. And so what I started doing was just making up a little sign that said, ask an atheist. And I would let John preach and get his crowd, and I would hold the sign maybe, you know, 30, 40 feet off to the side and just hold my ask an atheist sign and let people come to me. And they would. I mean, I wouldn't get a huge amount, but I would get, you know, 4 people, 6 people, sometimes 10 or 12 people from all kinds of backgrounds. Some of them were Christian. Some of them were Hindu, some were Buddhist, some said they didn't know, they grew up in the church, they didn't know what they believed. One day I was doing that, and I had 2 students who were in a big class of mine, a 330-person intro to psychology class. So I didn't recognize them, they recognized me. And they said, Dr. Saplita, you're our professor for our Psych 1101 class, and we thought maybe you were an atheist. Based upon some things you said in class, some comments you made about religion, little jabs, but you know, we were hoping you were, but it's good to hear that you actually are. We have an organization on campus. We're starting up a new club this fall called UGA Atheists, and we need a faculty advisor for that club. And so I said, hey, I'm your guy, sign me up. And so I became the faculty advisor for UGA Atheists. As you guys are aware, I got really busy. Sometimes you can have the best of intentions with projects like this. You have no, then you find, come to find out, you have no time to invest in it. That was the case the first year. Then I remembered thinking the second year, if I'm going to do this, I want to do it right. I want to be really involved. I want to really get to know them. I want to do presentations. I want to bring in guest speakers. And so I started doing that. That would have been like the probably the fall semester of 2010. and I got more into it than ever, right? And I look back now, and I don't know exactly what changed, but all I know that there was a big change there during that winter break, during that, you know, that 3 weeks or so between the fall semester and the spring semester. And what I remember, what I can recollect about it, because I didn't know where it was going at the time, I just remember thinking, you know, I'm an atheist, and we pride ourselves on being people of reason, people of logic, people who weigh out the evidence and make a rational decision. We call ourselves free thinkers. And it occurred to me, it's like a little light bulb moment. That's not how I got here. I am where I am, but if I'm being honest, that's not how I got here. I decided to be here, and it was very much a matter of being cultured, right? It wasn't a matter of, okay, put God on the left-hand side of the page, put atheism on the, or no God on the right, draw a line down the middle and start thinking critically about arguments for or against. I don't know anybody who does that. And maybe there's somebody out there who's done that, but it certainly wasn't me. And so from my attitude was, well, I may remain an atheist, but I really want to start thinking about this, you know, trying to be as objective as possible. Maybe atheism isn't the best worldview. And so I started thinking through maybe what you'd call some of the old college questions, right? I think that's, it started with philosophy. I'm a very introverted person. I'm very introspective. I'm one of these people that is happy going off on trails in the woods all afternoon with no radio and no technology, just to think thoughts and ruminate upon on ideas. And so I started doing that, and I realized right off as a cognitive scientist, one major problem with atheistic naturalism. The first one that I, kind of like the pebble in the shoe, you know, I couldn't quite shake, was the idea of choice or you know, volition or will, whatever you want to call it. The idea that we have a free will, we make choices, meaningful choices. And I thought, well, on my philosophy of atheistic naturalism, that the mind is what the brain does, and what is the brain? It's just this conglomeration of proteins and lipids and neurotransmitters all moving around in there. According to fixed laws of physics, plus nothing else, I'm like, that leaves absolutely no room anywhere for the idea of choice, right? So choice at most, according to that worldview, is an illusion. That's what it has to be. It has to be an illusion according to the naturalistic worldview. And then I thought some more about that. I'm like, well, maybe that's true, but none of us lives like that's true. Not a single person. The idea of choice is right at the heart of everything we orient our lives around. The idea that we make meaningful choices, that other people do, things that have nothing to do with morality, but I think more importantly, the ideas, the choices that people make that are moral decisions, right? You can test this, right? Turn on the news, right? And I'm not even asking. Whatever your political affiliations are, doesn't matter. Turn it on, and what do you hear people talking about? So-and-so did this, said this, shouldn't have done that. You know, eavesdrop at a conversation at a coffee shop. People were making the same types of statements about each other. Like, choice is literally everywhere. And so it occurred to me, am I going to continue with a worldview to accept that, to try to live that out, that really insists that, to me, the most obvious thing about reality, I gotta chalk up to being an illusion. To me, that's not a very satisfactory worldview. So I consider that to be a major failure of atheism. That kind of segued into what you guys would recognize as the moral argument for God. I didn't have that term for it at the time. I was kind of rediscovering the wheel, you know. But the idea there, classic C.S. Lewis, where he begins Mere Christianity, the idea that there is this moral law, right, that everybody appeals to throughout the day to evaluate their own behaviors, but usually other people's behaviors. We're much better at applying it to other people than we are to ourselves, right? And so I kind of realized that's true. There might be some things like subjective morals. I was used to teaching about that, like let's say wardrobe or attire. that can be subjective and vary greatly from culture to culture, situation to situation. But you don't see that with things like murder or sexual assault or theft. A great example C.S. Lewis uses, or at least, you know, okay, let me go. C.S. Lewis talks about the idea of cultures. Culture might say you can have one wife, or you can have three wives, or you can have five wives, but nobody says you can have any wife that you want, right? You're never going to find a culture where people are considered noble for betraying the people that have treated them the nicest. This idea of betrayal is something that all cultures, all people, find to be morally repugnant. And so I'm like, there is moral truth, but that doesn't jibe with naturalistic evolution. If naturalistic evolution is true, then morality has to boil down to subjectives, right? The brain fizz in your skull and the brain fizz in my skull have different moral opinions, but really, at the end of the day, that's all they are. You know, we would say, you say, well, sexual assault, that's just your opinion. Somebody else's opinion is that's fine to do. Nobody's going to buy that. I don't know a single atheist that's going to buy that. But see, their worldview doesn't allow for anything else. And so there were a lot of these. The last one I'll give you, because there were several, was the uniqueness of humans, what I call the phenomenal uniqueness of humans. I taught a lot about evolutionary psychology, so I was familiar with the research on primates and chimpanzees and, you know, some ideas of rudimentary morality in chimps. Of course, they greatly emphasize things like genetic similarity. But if you're honest, you think about how we really are as a species, what things we value, what things we spend our time doing, and you compare that to a gorilla or a chimpanzee, and then compare chimpanzees to animals like dogs and deer and squirrels, there's more similarities between the chimp and the dogs and deers and squirrels behaviorally, how they conduct their lives, than there is between chimps and humans. You know, we're that's a quantum leap. It's not a matter of just a small quantitative difference. It's a huge qualitative difference. The things that we focus our lives on, artistic expression, sculpture, painting, poetry, technology. Chimps will take a stick and they'll sharpen an end of it to use as a little primitive spear. That's the apex of chimp technology. With human beings, just a couple years ago, we sent a rocket to land on a comet. Do you guys remember that? And so, to me, it's just this vast, if we're going to be honest, this vast gulf of difference. And we may have different opinions about how that happened mechanistically, but to me, it's undeniable that difference is a very real difference. And so somewhere there in it was early 2011, I'd say March of 2011, I was like, I don't know what I am, but I know I'm not an atheist, right? Like, I knew I had to bail on that movement. I'm not going to be a militant atheist anymore. I had no plans on leaving secular humanism. I just knew I wasn't an atheist. For a while there, I tried the higher power thing. I'm like, okay, you know, I actually was going with a friend. This wasn't me. I mean, I've had my problems in life. There are plenty of them. Substance addiction was never one of them. But one of my legitimate best friends that I rode my motorcycle with a lot was and still is a recovering narcotics addict. And I started going to NA meetings with him. And I had an interest in this just because of being a professor who often taught on addictions. I had the textbook knowledge, but I had no interactions with actual addicts themselves. And so I started going along with him the same era, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I was quiet at the meetings, but it was really fascinating to me to hear the stories of the addicts and how they would all appeal to their higher power. Their higher power wants them to stay sober. God, as they understand God, wants them to have good relationships, wants them to hold down a steady job. And I'm like, okay, this is right up my alley. I'm not an atheist anymore. I just need a higher power. That's all the further I'm going with this thing. And so I did that for like a month. And at the end of the month, I was like, this doesn't really work, because the problem is I really do believe that there is a higher power now. There is some type of God. I don't want it to be the Christian God, because I grew up with that. I don't want to ever go back to that. That was my thinking at the time. But I realized that it wasn't up to me to determine God's attributes or characteristics. If there is a God, then God is who God is, and my job is just to figure that out to the best of my ability and then kind of submit or surrender myself to that reality. And so not coincidentally, and so I remember thinking, I just want to know the truth. I'm not coincidentally, God intercepted me at this point in time with the man who's now the senior pastor of my home church in Athens, who was with a different church at the time. And they were having an outreach on the campus of the University of Georgia called the Great Exchange. It's survey-based, where they just ask a few questions about your spiritual background, who in your opinion is Jesus Christ, on a scale of 1 to 10, how morally good of a person are you, and then some diagnostic questions, like if God were to ask you, you know, why should I let you into heaven, what would you say? And I think the last question on the survey is, if you could know God personally, would you like to? So the point of the survey is to have gospel conversations and then opportunities to share the gospel. First time they'd ever done that, it was on Good Friday at the University of Georgia of the spring of 2011. And so I get to know David. I give him all the atheist answers for the first half hour or so, but then I'm honest with him. I'm like, okay, I'm not, but you know, I've been giving you the atheist answers. I told him, I said, I actually am the atheist club advisor here at UGA, but something really interesting's happened with me these last few months. I'm no longer an atheist. I know I'm not. I believe in some type of God. I really don't want it to be the Christian God, but if that's where truth is to be found, that's the direction I want to go in. So what we started doing is just meeting every week at Starbucks in downtown Athens and just having conversations. One of the questions he asked me, which I think is an important question, he said, you know, what are the obstacles? What do you see as the intellectual obstacles between you and faith in Jesus Christ? And I said, well, two things pop into my mind right away. Number one is evolution. I said, I am an absolute dyed-in-the-wool Darwinist, and I was at the time. That hadn't changed. That changed later. But I said, I don't see how. That's science. My mind will never change about that. And he's like, I thought he was going to start, you know, kind of in a friendly way, kind of debating me, but he didn't. He's like, well, okay, anything else? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, there is. I said, I have a big problem with this Christian doctrine of hell. You know, how could a loving God send people to hell to perish forever just because they didn't believe certain religious ideas? And to my surprise, he really didn't start, rebutting that either. Here's what he said. He said, Rich, he's like, I can tell you're being honest with me. I've gotten to know you these last few weeks. He's like, let me challenge you to do something. He said, let me challenge you. Those are important questions. You're going to have to deal with those. But put them on the back burner. If you don't mind, just for now, put them on the shelf. You can get to those later. But it seems like God is really opening your mind and kind of like causing you to be fascinated with this person, Jesus of Nazareth, who he really was historically, how reliable are the Gospels. I had been looking into that at the time. I'd realized that a lot of the stuff I was saying as an atheist was wrong. I really bought into the Bart Ehrman stuff, late high Christology, the idea that the early church made Christ God, that he never claimed to be anything like that. You know, ideas that the Gospels were written in the second century rather than the first century, that by different authors. And the more research I did about those things, I'm like, no, whatever we can say about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have every reason to believe that the names fit the authors, that they were genuine. They were written by eyewitnesses or firsthand eyewitnesses. So I was at this point with Jesus where I'm like, I got to do something with him. So David and I started talking about that. And he asked me about the resurrection. And I thought, well, there's no reason why I have to disbelieve the resurrection. Now, when I was an atheist, I couldn't believe in the resurrection. But now as a theist, I can be open to that. And so he's like, well, why don't you go back and reevaluate? He said, have you read? He's like, well, he said, first of all, let me just ask you, where are you with the likelihood of the resurrection? If you had to put a number on it, what would you say? And I said, I have no idea, 50-50, I guess. Did it really happen? I don't know. I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to say yes. I'm just kind of like 50-50. And he's like, well, that's good. He's like, do you have a Bible? And I knew where this was going. And I said, yeah. I said, I have my old Bible from when I was in my early 20s, NIV Study Bible. It's there on my shelf between two neuroscience books. And he said, well, what if I challenge you to read the Gospel of John between now and when we meet next week? And I remember thinking, I didn't say this to him. I said, yeah, I'll read it. And I'm thinking to myself, I'll read it, but it's not going to make a difference. I mean, how's reading the Gospel of John going to take me? I already know what it says. I know that the Bible says that God raised Jesus from the dead. There's no new information in there for me. So I said, yeah, sure, David, I'll do it. And so I went home and I didn't do it. And until the night before we were going to meet again. And I was cleaning, straightening up my little apartment, which was kind of a small miracle in and of itself because I was not a big cleaner. And there it is. It catches my attention, my NIV Study Bible, and it cues my memory. And it's like, yeah, I told David I would read the Gospel of John. We're meeting tomorrow. I haven't done that. It's only like 7 p.m. I don't have a good excuse, right? Like, I literally have nothing else to do tonight, so I'll sit down and read it. And then it flashed through my mind again, but it's not going to make a difference. How's that going to change my mind about Jesus? But, you know, long story shorter, I sat down on the couch and I started reading. And, of course, my memories was cued to a lot of stories I remembered as a kid that I hadn't revisited for quite some time. For whatever reason, for me, it was John 11, story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. I don't know why. To this day, I can't tell you why. That's what the Holy Spirit decided to use as kind of like the thing to put the spotlight on who Jesus was. And it's where Jesus is having dialogue with Martha. You know, they were disappointed because according to them, Jesus let their brother die. They were kind of ticked off at him. I get that sense. You know, they were sad, but they were also very disappointed with Jesus. Rabbi, if you'd been here, our brother would have lived, which was true. But Jesus stayed away. But even now, we know that whatever you ask of God, he will grant you. And then Jesus says, what does he say? He says, your brother will rise again. And Martha doesn't quite get it, right? Like, we wouldn't either. And she's like, I know, like, you know, at the end of days, on the last day, when God resurrects all people, that he'll be raised. And Jesus is like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And the thing that really stuck out in my mind is Jesus' claim where he says, I am the resurrection and the life. I think it's John 11:25. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even if he dies, yet he will live. And the one who lives and believes in me will never die. Right? And then he points at her and he says, do you believe this? You guys, you remember that, right? He's asking, and it's kind of like Jesus was sitting next to me on the couch, you know, and I felt the finger pointing to me and saying, do you believe this? Another thing I recognized about that passage was it wasn't about, of course, Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, but it wasn't about what Jesus could do. It wasn't about power. It was about his identity. He didn't say, I can accomplish resurrection and I can give life. He could, but his statement was about who he was. It was about his identity. And that's the real epiphany I had at the time. That Christianity is not even, it is about what God can do and what God has done, but more important than that, it's about who God is. And that's what this thing is. Of course, Jesus can raise the dead if his identity is resurrection and if his identity is life. Of course he can raise the dead. That just flows from his identity. And so the Holy Spirit used that to erase my doubts about the resurrection. Like, this guy is who he claimed to be, and since that is his identity, of course he rose from the dead. And so I met David the next day, and I said, well, I don't have doubts anymore. I believe that that's true about Jesus. He was ecstatic. I wasn't. You know, like, again, going back to Lewis, and I don't want to strain comparisons. Lewis was light years ahead of me intellectually, anywhere where I could ever hope to be. And, you know, this was a question that burned in his mind for 2 years before he became a Christian. But it was kind of like the same. You've heard Lewis describe himself as the most reluctant convert in all of England. I don't know if I was the most reluctant convert in America. Probably not, but I was pretty reluctant. I did not want to become a Christian. I was kind of mad at myself in a way, but it was this real, like, cognitive dissonance moment between, like, I really believe this is true, but this is really going to screw up my life. And so that's what happened. I'll summarize here real quickly before we do a few questions. So what I did is I went through, I mean, I really believed it. In my head, I was a Christian. In my head, I believed that God rose Jesus from the dead. It never changed after that moment. In terms of making it from my head to my heart, that required about another 3 years, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of pains, a lot of struggles, a lot of failures. But, you know, at the end of the day, God gave me a new heart. He did that in my particular situation by causing a sort of a perfect storm of events that really kind of crushed me. But God used that to bring life where there was nothing but death. I really got with the program. My heart and my head matched up sometime late in 2014, and I left UGA. I started going to seminary to study apologetics. I talked to my pastor a long time about, you know, should I consider this? And he was very affirming. Met Tom Short the following spring and started traveling with Truth on Display. And I spent a fall semester and the following spring semester interning with Tom. Tom brought me on staff the following spring of 2016, and I've continued to work with public outreach, public ministry, kind of a hybrid evangelism and apologetics ministry since then. This fall, I was brought on by UGA. You guys have heard of Ratio Christi. Are you familiar with Ratio Christi? We just have a small little Ratio. We're trying to grow it, but the old director invited me to be the new campus director for that. So God's opening up these new doors to keep on interacting with students on campus, and just very thankful for that. My wonderful wife, Mary, we were friends. We decided we both had blown it as far as dating was concerned, and we didn't come to know Christ until our early 40s independently. And so what we decided to do was, we're not going to date. We're just going to stay really good friends, which we did, and we're still going to keep working ministry. God kept opening ministry opportunities for her, ministry opportunities for me. He brought those together at numerous points in time. But we went through a three-year period where we were just friends, literally just best friends, and kind of like, God, if you want us to get married, then give us the green light. And he did that late last spring, and we got married last summer. So after all these chances of blowing it and doing it wrong, you know, God provides redemption in the middle of that. And so I'll just close with a verse before we do Q&A. It was from my reading from Galatians chapter 1, just my devotional reading. And I'm probably going to mess it up, but it's the last verse in the chapter. And Paul is talking about, you know, his conversion. And he reports about the Judean churches, how the Judean churches heard that the one who had been persecuting them was now preaching the gospel that he once tried to destroy. And I love what he says right after that. And it says, and they thanked God, or they praised God for that. You know. And so again, I realize how none of this is about me. It's about what God is doing. It hasn't been pretty, but it's God's will being accomplished. And people who understand the gospel, people who love the gospel, people who understand how God takes broken people and changes them and commissions them, how do we receive that? We rejoice when we see that happening in the life of a new believer. So I'm just so thankful you guys invited me to come and let me share a little bit of my story with you. Yeah. Thanks.
Questions?
Roberto, yeah.